Hello and welcome to the Personnel Today Friday podcast. I'm Tara Craig and I'm joined by Louisa Peacock and Kat Baker. Coming up, we discuss a new clause in the Equality Bill which will ban pre-employment health questionnaires. We hear from Tim Miller, Standard Chartered Bank's HR Chief and Personnel Today's 2009 Top HR Power Player, and we look at the Met Police's plans for the London Olympics in 2012. But first, the news. British Airways cabin crew have ruled out striking over Easter. If as expected, a ballot on industrial action endorses a walkout that could ground the entire airline. Network Rail has kicked off a new campaign aimed at attracting more female recruits. It wants to tackle outdated perceptions of the rail industry, which have led to a huge waste of talent. The French Parliament is considering a law forcing big companies to appoint women to 40% of boardroom seats. The law gives companies 6 years to comply, but is broadly supported by the government and likely to pass into law in amended form this year. You can read these and other news stories in full on personneltoday.com. Louisa, pre-employment questionnaires will become illegal under new proposals outlined in the Equality Bill. What does this mean for employers?
Thanks, Tara. That's right. The House of Lords on Tuesday this week put a clause in the bill to ban pre-employment health questionnaires. What this means is that employers will no longer be able to ask job candidates about their health conditions, medical conditions, any history of illness prior to the job offer. At the moment, employers can actually ask candidates those questions on job application forms, and they can be quite varied and wide questions, such as, do you have any health issues? Now, this is going to be ruled out if this change goes through the bill. Now, what employers can ask is questions that are relevant to the job in hand. So, for example, in the construction industry, there are lots of jobs which require staff to either climb ladders, go up tall buildings, and etc. So if the job candidates suffer from vertigo, obviously that would be something they needed to disclose before coming to interview, because obviously that could have a massive implication on the job. Other examples are, someone gave me was an electrician who was colourblind, and obviously he couldn't be able to tell the difference between the wires that he's trying to work with during the day. So there are sort of cases above and beyond the sort of obvious mental health or people in wheelchairs. You know, there are cases out there that are hidden that could prevent people from doing the job in hand. So in those cases, employers would be able to find out about that.
Why have they brought this in? Why did they think it was necessary?
Well, campaign groups have argued for many years that employer discrimination against people with medical conditions is rife. In fact, there was a report out a couple of years ago from the government that said fewer than 4 in 10 employers would actually hire staff with mental health problems.
Who's actually in favour of this ban?
Well, like I say, campaign groups have been arguing for years that people with disabilities or medical conditions are discriminated against. So we have all sorts of mental health charities and disability charities who are for the ban. Remploy, which helps those with disabilities find work, also said it's a good idea as long as I was trying to explain earlier, those people with conditions disclose conditions that aren't actually relevant for the job. So if it's something that's completely irrelevant to the job, then yes, it's a good idea. Employers actually, surprisingly perhaps, have come out and backed the ban as well. HR directors, leading HR directors from various companies have said that actually, you know, it would be naive to suggest that nobody discriminates against these people with these health issues. Donna Miller, HR Director at Enterprise Rent-A-Car, told Personnel Today that she does accept that employers discriminate against those with health issues. She said once line managers get hold of something detrimental on a health form, there's little chance for that applicant to then go through the hiring process. They get kicked out at the first stage possible. So at least what this will do is, rather than allow employers to discriminate, it will actually make them judge based on skills, qualifications and experience of that applicant as whether they're suitable for the job, as opposed to anything to do with their health condition.
What's the legal response to this been?
Well, employment lawyers, again, have been surprisingly for this ban. They're actually moving to calm fears that good employers could be caught out by the changes. So Simon Rice-Birchall, who's the partner at Eversheds law firm, told me that employers were still entitled to screen people about health as long as it's after the job offer. And in that circumstance, if something came up on their health form that would actually be detrimental to them doing the job, employers are well within their right to say, actually, we can't hire you anymore, as long as there's a justifiable business case for it. You know, he's arguing as well that this gives the case that employers don't have to discriminate, or won't be allowed to discriminate before this person gets the job. And once they then know about any health issues, they either have to make reasonable adjustments in the workplace, or they simply say, no, actually, there's a justifiable reason as to why we can't offer you this job anymore and you can withdraw it. So He's actually saying that employers with a genuine reason why candidates can't perform the role on health grounds have nothing to worry about. So that's quite good news.
Are we looking at a situation where people are going to withhold information on their health and then just a few months down the road, employers find they've hired someone who can't do the job?
Well, no, this is still about, it's just about when you ask the information. You can't ask the information during the recruitment process. Once you've conducted the interviews and offered that person the job, you can immediately then ask them to fill out a health form, to go to a health screening third-party provider, to thoroughly check them as much as you'd like to, and then is when it would come out as to whatever issue they've got. So it wouldn't be that you suddenly start employing the person and months down the line it emerges they've got a history of mental health. You know, it would actually come out, supposedly, as soon as you've offered them the job, and then, you've still got your notice period and whatnot to work with that employee to try and make those reasonable adjustments. And like I said earlier, if you can't make those reasonable adjustments and there's a genuine business reason for not being able to do that, then you'll be all right if it got to tribunal. You'd be able to present your case in saying that we couldn't employ this person after all. So, all this is doing really is allowing employers to make the decision about whether someone's suitable for a job based on their experience and skills rather than anything to do with their health. As one HR director put it, I work in HR, I'm not a doctor, how would I know?
Thanks, Louisa. Deputy Editor Mike Berry recently interviewed Tim Miller, Standard Chartered Bank's HR Chief and Personal Today's 2009 Top HR Power Player. He began by asking him how much the reputation of banks had been damaged by their actions during the financial crisis.
They used to say that estate agents were at the bottom of the food chain. I now think in many cases it's bankers in terms of public reputation. And that's regrettable because there are a lot of very good things that banks do, which of course have been forgotten in the crisis and the public furore that it's created. I mean, banks are vital to any successful economy. The question is, how do you govern and manage them, and how do you ensure they're taking appropriate risk for appropriate reward? But I do believe that the industry has been damaged. It is taking a long, hard look at itself about what it needs to do, how it needs to operate. But that's going to take time. And I think the important thing is, as regulators and governments respond to the crisis, that we do so in a measured way. Because there's a real danger that you can over-regulate something, you can put on layer and layer of so-called controls and regulation, but actually doesn't make that activity any less risky. Arguably, some would say, it makes it more risky. So it's finding the right balance of more and adequate supervision by regulators, but in such a way that it still allows the organisations to operate effectively.
Do you think that the drive for increased transparency on pay and corporate governance as well, do you think that's kind of an acknowledgement of HR failures in financial services firms?
Certainly, I think if a firm fails because of a perceived weakness or between risk and reward, then HR has to share its burden of the blame. And to that extent, yes, HR has failed in certain organisations to properly manage the relationship between reward, risk, and pay. Also, I believe that usually there must be some sort of issue around culture in some of these organisations that's caused them to fail. As I said before, when you compare the official structures of RBS, HBOS, Lloyds, ourselves and other banks, then they look remarkably similar. The differentiator is how they're operated, and I think that's where HR perhaps has not been up to the mark in some of those failed institutions.
Kat, we heard this week that the Metropolitan Police is to use special constables to police the 2012 Olympics. The Olympics are going to be a huge policing operation. I mean, for a start, how many extra officers are they going to need?
Yeah, I spoke to Martin Tipley, the HR director of the Met Police, earlier in the week about how he's preparing his workforce for the Olympics in 2012. Although he refused to outline exactly how many officers he would need to cover the security measures for the Olympics, he did say that he was looking to more than double the number of unpaid special constables. So increasing the numbers that they have currently, 2,700 to 7,000 by 2012, and that the force would also look to beg, borrow and steal police officers from other forces around the country to try and plug the gaps. The Police Federation, however, said that the Met Police could have to draft in 1,000 extra police officers a day to try and cover the Olympics.
Did Martin Tiplady have anything to say about, you know, what he was going to do with all of these extra special constables after the Olympics?
No, he wouldn't outline that. At the moment, they're still at the very early stages of trying to work out exactly what staff they'll need and where they'll need to have them. The Met Police and the Association of Chief Police Officers are currently working on the Demand and Resources Project, which is looking at which officers they'll need and which areas they'll be needed. But as yet, I don't think there's any information on what will happen to these officers afterwards.
I guess the whole point of hiring specials is that because they're unpaid volunteers, you can hire them in for a couple of weeks and then ask them to, you know, ask them to leave. You don't need to sort of have them hanging around as you were. And I think, from my understanding of the story, is that was what Martin's point was as well, in that, you know, we don't need to hire permanent PCs, we just need to get extra support in for the couple of weeks that the Olympics is running.
Special constables, do they have the same powers as regular police officers?
They do, yep. They have exactly the same powers, but they're just volunteers who are unpaid. So the Met Police could call upon them and say, I need you to do a certain number of shifts this week, and they'll have to notify their employer that they need to do this. But then if they're no longer needed the week after, then they may not have any shifts.
Yeah, generally it's quite a flexible workforce that the police can use. However, they are unpaid and they are volunteers, which the Police Federation said could cause extra problems.
I spoke to Jeff Stutterford, who's a Met Inspector who sits on the Police Federation's Olympic Working Group. He basically expressed concern that because the special constables are volunteers, that there's no way that a police force could force them to come into work if they didn't want to. So if, say, for example, they turn around and decided they wanted to go and watch the Olympics themselves, the Met Police could be left understaffed if they'd been relying on their services.
Potentially we're looking at some very last-minute staff shortages there.
Yes, I mean, yes, that's right, Tara. But I think the Met Police is hoping that with a network of 7,000 special constables, they might be able to fill those gaps.
So I know these special constables are volunteers, but what sort of budget are we looking for security for the Olympics?
Again, we don't have specific details on the actual budgeting for policing, but the Home Office has said that the whole security package for the London Olympics could come to £600 million.
And, I mean, as Martin Tiplady said, there are going to be a lot of people on overtime during the Olympics. Thanks, Kat. Well, that's it from this week's podcast. Thank you for listening. Remember to go online to check the latest news and views from the HR community at hrspace.co.uk. Until next week, goodbye.